There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is February the 12th. My name is Brian Jefferson.
And I'm Alice Wu, and we will be your hosts today.
CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyenkehaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. We're broadcasting from Jojage, or so-called Montreal.
On today's show, we'll talk about outbreaks of COVID-19 in the largest provincial prison, hear about a court decision to change the Quebec Civil Code, and as always, give you news you can use. Don't miss it. We'll be back in a moment.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
But first, some news. An outbreak of more than 40 COVID-19 cases at College Stanislas in Outremont led to an announcement Wednesday that the private school would close its doors for at least a week. Montreal health officials suspect at least one of the 40 cases is linked to the British coronavirus variant.
A new warming tent has been created behind the Montreal Metro. The tent can house 15 people and is open from 8 p.m. to 7 a.m. This is the second tent of its kind in Montreal for unhoused people. The other is in Cabot Square, and it's in honor of Raphael Napa Andre. Organizers announced this week that it will remain open until March 31st, and they're looking for more donations to keep it running.
And also, in honor of Raphael Napa Andre, an art projection will be shining on the side of the open door shelter on Park Avenue for the next 3 days. The projection is by artist Isaac Murdoch, Annick Boivin, and Simon Rock.
And Miss Ben's Black History Month series continues on CKUT every Tuesday of this month. She talked about doulas and health systems this past week.
Hi, so start from the beginning. My blood sugars were as low as 3.2, 2.4, and this is pretty dangerous. And I was lucky enough to wake up, because had I not, I would have been in a coma. And worse, I could have died. After a while, I also noticed that my stomach didn't really feel like that was gas anymore. When I went to the hospital, the doctor checked me out and did advise me that it's possible that I either had pancreatic cancer or a brain tumor. And at this point, before I went through the vigorous screenings and tests, I had to take a blood test and a pregnancy test. And that's how I found out I was 16 weeks pregnant. From then, that very day, actually, I went to see an OBGYN. And she came into the room and she told me that she doesn't usually do this, or actually she has never done this, but that she does not advise me to have this child and that I need to book an appointment to get an abortion. The baby will not make it through long term or through the full term, and that it would just be easier for me to deal with and to get over and to move on with my life. It's also the possibility of me going completely blind. And then, you know, the other complications that occur just in regular pregnancies. I cried. And I cried. And I cried. I was originally told that I had no chance in being pregnant. So, to even know that I was this far along, when you get that first ultrasound and you hear the heartbeat and you see the baby's full limbs, so far along that I knew the sex of the baby, it was crazy. It was so crazy. At this point, it was a no-brainer. I'm not going to have the baby. So I was told. But I also was not going to terminate my pregnancy. If this was the most pregnant I was going to be, I wanted to enjoy every day that it lasted. And if my child was not going to make it, it was up to them of when they were going to leave. So I said that I was naturally going to miscarry. The doctors told me, well, you know, 21 weeks, let's see if you can make it to 22 weeks.
You can tune into this show on CKUT every Tuesday this month from 3 to 5 p.m.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask, and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips, and if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5. My name is Brian. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, Montrealers demonstrated across the city in the last week for different reasons, but all centered on the question of what justice is and who can give it. Sarah Jesmer walks us through some of what happened starting at the Bordeaux prison.
Nadia's gray sweatpants are dampening in the knee-high snow as she uses her full chest to call into the megaphone. She's calling to her partner in Bordeaux. Bordeaux Prison, or Montreal as it's known, is the largest provincial jail in Quebec. It's a men's facility on the north shore of the island near Ahuntsic. The building looks somewhat medieval, with dark small windows. Right outside their long driveway is a daycare and a CHSLD. Bordeaux is experiencing a unique outbreak of COVID-19 this week among detainees. Official counts say it started spiking among the people there last week. At its peak via Wednesday's update, 121 of their nearly 870 inmates that day were actively infected. And as of Friday, February 12th, today, 119 out of 846 people are actively infected. And it's not the first outbreak at Bordeaux. Advocates like the Montreal branch of anti-carceral group fights for the rights of incarcerated people. They're here today in the cloudy, snowy Sunday afternoon like they've been many times before. There's seven gray cars stalled on the two-way street. The four doors are all gray, like Nadia's wet sweatpants. Some cars have one person in them, some have a few. The caravan pauses after they roll slowly away from the entrance. Then they pierce the silence. The honking goes on for a few minutes until Nadia leaves her car headed for the black spiked gate that surrounds Bordeaux. She calls out. The honking stops, and she turns her ear directly to the prison as she strains to hear something back. And faintly, there's a voice. The two call back and forth as the line of cars wait patiently. You're not animals, she says. We're hearing what's going on there with you. She can't make out everything that he's saying, but there's one message that's easily understood. Car honks and chants slow, Nadia returns to her car. A police car has also just pulled up to ask that the traffic keep moving. The group is getting ready to leave anyway, so there's no incident. Nadia says she's okay, but feels for her partner inside, who is stripped of any normal resources.
Moi bien, mais de savoir que lui est là, avec aucune ressource, rien du tout. Ça vient me chercher. Mais je sais qu'il est fait fort, mais comment ça trouver ça dur?
She's been here at this place at least four times before, calling out. She says again that if she could share one message with the people inside, it's that you are not animals. They're people, just like you or me, even as they live in dehumanizing conditions.
Il faut leur montrer qu'on est plus fort que eux, malgré qu'ils sont considérés comme des animaux. C'est pas tous des animaux. C'est des êtres humains comme vous et moi.
For her, justice does not come from being locked up. It's a question that's related to class, she says, and just look at how the law treats people of color, too.
Ah, la justice appartient aux riches, là. La classe moyenne, c'est de la chenoute, puis les pauvres, c'est encore pire. Ça a toujours été comme ça, puis je pense que ça changera jamais. Tu sais, les Juifs qui ont droit de faire des rassemblements, ah, c'est vrai, eux, ils ont de l'argent. Ceux qui en ont pas, faut qu'ils restent seuls chez eux. C'est vrai pareil. Fait qu'il y en a pas de justice. Fait juste à regarder le cas avec le policier qui s'est fait agresser, là. C'est ça. Fait que tu vois là, déjà là, t'es noir, t'es déjà jugé. Fait que c'est comme il y en a pas. Non.
Ted Rutland is a member of the anti-carceral group. His four-door slowly led the caravan at the front. He wore a gray toque and a red-bricked patterned mask that made it look like he was speaking from behind a wall. Rutland says the situation in prisons across Canada have only gotten worse since the first wave. Anti-carceral group demanded some inmates be decarcerated to allow for people to socially distance in their communities, which would help remaining prisoners remain socially distanced inside.
The federal prison system reneged on this. They would not decarcerate, and the Quebec system would not decarcerate. And so here we are in the second wave, and they're still not implementing that. They're moving much more quickly to lock down entire sectors when one person in a sector tests positive. And so the result is that if someone feels that they have symptoms, they don't reveal them, they don't ask for a test or accept a test out of solidarity with the other people in their sector, because everyone in the whole sector is going to be locked down 24 hours a day. And we could predict, and we have been predicting for a long time, what that would do. And it produced exactly the result that we expected. People didn't reveal that they had symptoms. It spread. And now we're in the situation where the entire prison, 900 people, are being punished because the prison mishandled the situation from the beginning.
The group has strong communication systems with people in specific facilities, like Bordeaux.
There have been no visits from the outside for almost a year now. There's been no social programs or educational programs for almost a year now. The library at Bordeaux has been closed for almost a year now. The gym has been closed. People obviously don't have access to the outside now that it's winter. And people are bored to tears. In provincial prisons, you can't bring in a television set, unlike in federal prisons where if you have the money, you can buy one. So people are sitting there listening to the radio and staring at the wall. People are right now under lockdown conditions. They have restricted access to phone calls. So some people have gotten 1 5-minute phone call in the week of lockdown. They've had one shower in the week. People are suffering. And you know, as Nadia said, who's with us today and whose partner is inside, I mean, a lot of people deal very badly with prison time anyway. I mean, it's a terrible place to be in the best of times. And now they've taken the minimal things away that make life livable for some people away.
They're here to show that people are not forgotten and to draw attention to the conditions inside.
But we do hear that people appreciate it. On a sunny day in the summer, people's windows are open and we can have a back and forth. We can yell at them, they can yell back at us. Today we had a little bit of that.
This group is a co-signee of what activists, prison and policing abolition leaders are calling a historic Canadian declaration. The declaration focuses on defunding current carceral systems from coast to coast, dismantling dependency on police, and building alternatives to safety by putting money elsewhere.
And that's something that people have been fighting for a really long time. In so-called Canada and around the world, and most of the signatories have been fighting for a long time. What I think we've seen since the beginning of the pandemic is, first of all, the pandemic brings attention to existing structures of oppression and vulnerability that pre-existed the pandemic, but brings them a little bit more to light. And we've seen that really clearly in the case of these long-term care facilities in which we're confining our elderly. For example, the deaths in these long-term care facilities brought attention to the grave effects of COVID, but also the fact that things are not going well in long-term care facilities. And so ideally, this is a moment to notice the way that we're treating people and to make changes, not just to address COVID, but to make our institutions function better. And so I think COVID in prisons has prompted the same kind of thing. I mean, people are sick in prison because it's a sickly place. And ideally, this will be a moment where we not only try to ensure that people don't die of COVID, but also try to think about why we have so many prisons in the first place.
Rutland says this is a time to reimagine justice to focus more on care than punishment, a core principle that can be applied to a multitude of different cities.
You know, if we're to think about what this means in Montreal versus another place in the world, we need to recognize the importance of settler colonialism to making the injustice of our society. And so any call for justice has to be a call for Indigenous sovereignty and decolonization. We need, like anywhere else in the Americas, Montreal has a history of slavery. And so we need to think about the role of anti-blackness in constituting the oppressive structures of our society. And we need to support black people and their movements for liberation when we're calling for justice of any kind. But I also think that, it's significant to me that Montrealers have the lowest opinion of their police department anywhere in Canada. And I think that that's a reflection not just of the fact that our police department is terrible, but the fact that I think people are aware. I think that people are less trusting of these institutions that seem to be there to protect us. And so I think that there's something to build on there. Just because you don't trust the police doesn't mean that you're in favor of a world without police, but I think there's something that can be built on there. And so I take that as an encouraging sign that we don't have a lot of confidence in our police force.
Quebec holds people in detention centers pre-trial, which means there are people inside that have not been deemed guilty in court. He says that causes crowding inside, which leads to more risks of infection in the pandemic.
If you had to compare Quebec as a province to the rest of the provinces about how they're dealing with incarcerated people during the COVID, what would you say?
It's worse. I mean, Quebec is one of the only provinces that didn't significantly decarcerate in the first wave. They really refused. There was some movement on the part of the courts and the lawyers to see whether we could stop sending so many people into prison, obviously not in the case in the sense of forgiving people for crimes they've committed, but in terms of not holding people pretrial. There's a little bit of that, but very little. Ontario managed to decrease its prison population by something like 20-25%. In Nova Scotia, it was close to 40%. All stuff that's really easy to do. And, you know, there wasn't a big spike in murders in Nova Scotia, obviously, because we didn't used to incarcerate this many people. So we're not talking about going back to... We have an actual experiment that shows what society looks like when we don't incarcerate so many people. And it looks more or less like the society we have, except there are fewer people behind bars.
He says that everyone can get involved in this kind of work in some way. It can be something that can be incorporated into the work that people already do.
One of the things that I think is really powerful about it is it forces us to open our imagination. Because it takes some imagination to imagine a world without prisons and police when that's the world that all of us have pretty much been brought up in. And we're told from the time that we can hear that these institutions keep us safe. So it takes some learning to understand that they don't. And it takes some imagination and learning to understand that there are many things we could do that would be much better and that don't involve punishment and then that don't reinforce structures of violence and oppression in our society.
And these types of conversations happen just hours later near the Montreal Police Department downtown. Black Lives Matter Montreal, Tous les Hoods en Parlent, Hoodstock from Montreal North, and the Defund the Police Coalition. They're all here because of 31-year-old Mamadi Farah Camara. He's a Montreal teacher and a father who was falsely accused in the last 2 weeks of attacking an SPVM officer in Park Extension. Camara, who is Black, was held without charges for nearly a week before he was released. The city, including its officials and residents, have erupted in calls to name racial profiling and bring him justice.
Justice for Camara!
Camara has not yet spoken publicly about what he would define his justice to be. But these groups and community members say his case is part of a series of anti-Black racism and violence in Montreal, and this type of sentiment is in parallel within policing systems across the continent. Vincent Mousseau with Black Lives Matter read off names of lives lost some years ago, some just months ago. Their voice rang out over the sound of a generator in the back.
Justice for Mamadi Camara and his family. Justice for Sheffield Matthews. Justice for Nicholas Gibbs. Justice for Pierre Toriolan. Justice for Ali Magloire. Justice for Mohammadi. Justice for Tony Villanueva. Justice for Kylian Registre. Justice for all victims of SPVM violence and extrajudicial killings.
So again.
But it's important to remember that these forms of institutionalized white supremacy are not an error in the system, but rather the system working exactly as it was intended to.
Yes!
These actions are not only in line with the recent policy positions inside the SPVM itself, but also in the history of the institution of policing in North America. Descended from the runaway slave patrols of the American South, police forces in North America are the fruits of an active effort to surveil, control, and exert violence upon Black people. Their role since their inception was never the protection of our communities, but rather the protection of property. Such a system is rooted in anti-Blackness and will take more than an apology to rectify. The only way to rectify such a system is to massively cut the funding to police forces across the country with the eventual goal of abolishing them altogether. Justice, no peace! No justice, no peace! No justice, no peace! J'aimerais me tourner maintenant vers les politiciennes et les politiciens qui pourraient être ici présents. Vendredi passé, la mairesse de l'arrondissement de Villeray-Saint-Michel Parc Extension a pris la parole à une autre manifestation pour nous faire encore des promesses. Elle essayait de nous jeter de la poudre aux yeux en parlant de cette nièce ivoirienne et elle était là pour nous dire que c'est important que ça change. Et c'était pour ça qu'elle est venue participer à la manifestation. C'est peut-être juste moi, là. C'est pas elle qui est en position de pouvoir.
C'est juste moi qui pense que c'est plutôt elle qui a le pouvoir de changer les choses. Je suis content que les politiciennes et les politiciens se rendent compte du pouvoir collectif de l'organisation communautaire, mais son rôle, ce n'est pas nous faire des discours à nos manifs, mais bien de lutter dans les instances pour le bien-être de nos communautés. Nous, on s'occupera de la rue. Nous, on s'occupera de la rue. Pas besoin de ton aide là-dedans. Alors qu'un avis aux politiciennes et aux politiciens qui se disent... un avis aux politiciennes et aux politiciens qui se disent en solidarité avec nous. On n'a plus besoin de vos excuses. Pas besoin d'entendre parler de vos amis noirs pour justifier le fait que vous soyez de notre côté. Je vous rappelle que la solidarité, c'est l'amour en action. Si vous vous dites solidaire de nos luttes, prouvez-le par vos actes, pas par vos discours vides. And finally, a word to the black community. Let us not forget that Mamadi Camara is a trained engineer, a researcher and doctoral student at École Polytechnique, one of the best engineering schools in the country. And that's on top of being a father, soon to be father to two twins. We should be celebrating the black excellence that he radiates through his work. However, let's also remember that despite his achievements, his degrees were not enough to keep him safe from police aggression and profiling. No matter what our degrees or our job titles, the cars that we drive, or the money in our savings account, our skin marks us as different in the eyes of the state and its institutions. We're all the same to them. So as a community, let's knock it off with the respectability politics. Monsieur Camara did not deserve to be treated the way that he was, but that wasn't because of his degrees or because of his job, but rather because he's a human being who is intrinsically worthy of respect, love, and kindness. Merci beaucoup.
They're also demonstrating against sensational journalism and mass misrepresentation of marginalized communities in the media. This event doubles as a moment of reflection during Black History Month and joyful resilience. After the speakers shared their thoughts, the group of nearly 200 people started to dance to the music by DJ Mansa, who had a deck set up amongst the snow. This physical location is a spot of multiple demonstrations in the last year and beyond. Van Harry with Black Lives Matter says Black Montrealers are in this place of unrest symbolically, too, over and over and over again.
I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm trying to keep hope. I am fighting.
Harry says there's no reason for violent encounters with law enforcement, especially since they're trained.
Okay, someone is being accused of something. Well, these guys are trained to interact, diffuse situations. Why, when is it a black person, right away there is violence? Why someone having mental health problem ends up dead in the streets? Why? I mean, no one has the right answer. I am sorry, but even though you choose to be a cop, you choose to do this line of work that is, yes, dangerous sometimes, but why are you trigger happy? This is what we see. Trigger happy cop. I feel like cops in Montreal have this idea of what it is to be a cop, probably coming from the States, and they are bored. These guys are fucking bored, so whenever they find a chance to have some excitation, they fucking attack us. This is what's happening. We are getting attacked. Look at how indigenous people are being treated in the street. Like, we already have a problem there. These people get fined endlessly. They get bullied in the street. They have nowhere to go because the city, with the cops, are pushing them away more and more. And then cases like Camara that got arrested when he was the one calling the cops. How is that possible? How come they didn't search more when someone, there was a witness. There was a witness, but they listened to the cops. It doesn't make sense to us.
Harry says community members need to work together to create a new definition of safety.
I would say, come with us in the street. Listen to what we have to say. We are not exaggerating. We are living it every day. So, yeah, come with us. Just join us.
Montrealers are in a familiar place as individuals try to define what justice means in multiple facets of civil and private life. And after that individual reflection and defining, in many cases, it's the state or an institution that has the last word. Other demonstrations exemplified this in the last few days. A protest against indefinite extended curfew hours happened at Parc Émile Gamelin on Saturday. Another car rally rolled through the streets Sunday, calling for justice and awareness for the Tamil genocide in Sri Lanka. People rallied for social housing and housing rights near Charlevoix Metro. And teenager Miriam Boudawi was killed in a drive-by shooting this past weekend. This loss and others prompted the Montreal mayor and police officials to announce new anti-gun squads that will be increasing patrol in some already heavily policed neighborhoods. And after all this, the question remains with Montrealers en masse. What does true justice mean? And what do we do with our multiple definitions? If you're listening to this and you're incarcerated, CKUT has a radio show specifically to be a space for you to share your experiences. It's called The Prison Radio Show.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Alice Wu. Before we get to the next part of the show, some news you can use. No Climate Justice Without Social Justice is organizing a discussion about the links between climate change and migration justice in the Global South. Tune in on Wednesday, February 17th at 7 p.m. You can find the event details on the No Climate Justice Without Social Justice Facebook page. And a free film and art festival highlighting the work of Black and LGBTQ+ creators is happening right now. It's called the Masamadi Festival, and it runs until Thursday, March 11th. You can find details at the Masamadi Montreal Facebook page. Now for the second segment of the hour. A university group has helped bring a lawsuit to a Quebec Superior Court to change parts of the provincial civil code. After a six-year process, they won. Jada Joseph, with Concordia University's Center for Gender Advocacy, explains what that means for people like trans, non-binary, or intersex Quebecois.
Jada Joseph is the peer support training and drop-in coordinator at the Center for Gender Advocacy. What were some of the discussions that the center heard before this lawsuit came around in 2014?
We originally had filed a lawsuit against the Attorney General in 2014. And the lawsuit that we brought forth sought to invalidate 11 articles of the Quebec Civil Code, specifically articles 59, 62, 71, 93, 111, 115, 116, 124, 126, 132, and 146 of the Quebec Civil Code. And what we were arguing is that these particular codes intersectionally, as they, of course, impact individuals and multiple levels and at different intersections, it violates the rights, integrity, safety, freedom, dignity, as well as the privacy granted by the Quebec Charter of Rights, as well as the Canadian Charter of Freedoms and Rights of trans, non-binary, and intersex people living in Quebec. Before the lawsuit actually came about, it was spearheaded launched by Gabrielle Bouchard, who was our trans rights educator and advocate at that time. And she was, although also doing education work about trans awareness, she was also doing social work as well, in which she would assist individuals with name and sex designation change. And by virtue of doing this, she, and through her own lived experiences, of course, has witnessed the different barriers that trans folks navigated while trying to acquire name and or sex designation changes. And not only just the process of acquiring such, but also to how having access to these different changes intertwines with the lived experiences and the different ways people navigate their lives. So through housing, in education settings, in workspaces, this one macro level barrier definitely has interconnected impacts on people's lived experiences. So by virtue of that, you know, she acquired information to then present to our co-plaintiffs, as well as the two lawyers who also assisted us in this court case. And that's pretty much what led to this lawsuit.
Can you explain specific things that were being challenged?
So we had different aspects of the code that we wanted to change. For starters, we wanted for trans migrants to be able to change their name and sex designation, as currently only Canadian citizens who have been living in Quebec for over a year have the possibility of changing their name and sex designations in Quebec. So that was one. The other aspect that we wanted to change was for, with regards to sex designation options, only male or female is currently the only options available. And we also wanted to expand that so that it isn't only male or female, so that we can, respect and honor the fact that non-binary people are living and have been living for years. And thirdly, we also wanted to allow trans parents the possibility of changing their parental role from mother, father, or as well as parent. This was something that was really important, as you know, this not only reflects and honors the realities of trans families, and really acknowledges what these families look like by allowing for this. We also wanted to, by virtue of doing this, it allows for and guarantees privacy as well. And another aspect of the code that we wanted to remove was for trans youth to not have to receive medical evaluations by different mental health practitioners in order to obtain a name and or sex designation change, as well as removing parental veto, which allows parents to object their child's application for a name and or sex designation. Another part of the civil code that we wanted to remove as well is the requirement for sex designation at birth. That's a common thing that is practiced in North American societies and has been pushed by the West. And this was something we especially wanted to do while thinking about intersex children who forcefully undergo surgeries in order to uphold Western science needs of this two-sex system. Those are some of the articles that we wanted to strike down.
How does Quebec's civil code compare to the code of other provinces?
I don't have extensive knowledge, so I'm going to briefly talk about what I just simply know, one point. This is not an area that I'm expert in, but a really key piece is related to trans migrants. Quebec is one of the only provinces in Canada in which Canadian citizenship is required. If we look at other provinces such as Ontario, Canadian citizenship is not required. People are often required to have been living in the province for a period of 3 months to a year in which they're able to change their name and sex designation. So clearly, we see here that Quebec has a definite xenophobic and transphobic issue here.
Why is this not a federal issue? And how do those jurisdictions overlap?
Yeah, so I can talk about this in the context of, let's say, for trans migrants. So for people who have permanent residency on their PR cards and PR documents, it is possible to change your name and sex designation. However, you have to receive the approval through the province. So it's often provincially, it's the province on a provincial level in which people can access changing one's name and sex designation. And once that is completed, you can then do so on your PR document, which is under federal level. It's a federal provision, right? So it's the federal government that is responsible for that. So that's one example. And in the context of, for instance, birth certificates, it is under a provincial level. And this goes, this is the case for so many different things, like financially, like finances, social and whatnot. Often, you know, the federal government provides like a basic guideline. So for instance, such as the Canadian Charter of Rights, right? That is a basic guideline that all provinces try to live up to, and thus they then develop their own accordingly that they apply within their own province. However, provincial provinces often are awarded the responsibility of delegation. So pretty much the materialized aspects of people's lives, such as birth certificates and things of that matter, is under provincial jurisdiction.
What were the conversations that were happening at the center as you all waited for this decision from 2014 to now in 2021?
I really can't say again, unfortunately, because I'm not the person who has spearheaded the court case, which is Dalia Torkey. And the person who launched the court case was Gabrielle Bouchard. So these are like the two folks, and especially during the times in which we went into the trial. It's really Dalia Torkey. She was the one who was putting in the work. She was one who was speaking with interveners, in which the interveners of our case includes Égal Canada, LGBTQ Family Coalition, and Gender Creative Kids. She was the one who was working with our interveners. She was the one who was speaking with our lawyers, Audrey and Francois. She was the one who was speaking with our co-plaintiffs, Samuel Singer, Sarah Lumel, Abby Heller, and Jenna Jacobs. So those are, that's all her. I really want to emphasize that. So my response is going to be thus really limited, because I really want to honor and respect the fact that, yeah, she was the one who was doing that work. So I really want to highlight that. So in terms of from the things that I've seen from my perspective and what I've witnessed as the peer support drop-in coordinator, is that there was a lot of delegation that we had to do in the sense of planning out week by week the trial hearing. So when we had our hearings, ensuring that there were peer support volunteers to provide active listening, to ensure that there was enough staff present, ensuring that the appropriate experts were present, following up with experts and witnesses, you know, also rallying the community to attend the court hearings as well, which was definitely very challenging to hear the defense present very dehumanizing, quote unquote, evidence. So yeah, I would say that's kind of what it looked like during pre the court case actually happening. It was a lot of Dalia doing that work of connecting with the community and different interveners and organizations, as well as our co-plaintiffs and our witnesses as well. So yeah, it's really her. I want to just emphasize that tremendously.
Could you explain a little bit about the decision that you got in January, and did anything surprise you?
We were really happy to have received the decision, we waited a long time. We first had the trial in 2019, and then we only received the decision in January 2021. So it was a long, anxious year and some change of anxiety and just waiting for a long time, because there were so many, you know, people who are directly impacted by the results and, you know, the judgment. It is a 58-page document, so we had to wait for our lawyers to, you know, unpack that information, and we're still unpacking that information because it is so much. It's 58 pages. But from that, what we were able to gather, and what we also know for sure, is that the judge, Justice Gregory Moore, he rendered many things unconstitutional, such as the requirement that people could only be designated as either male or female, as well as the fact that trans parents are unable to change their parental role from mother, father, or parent on their children's birth certificates, as well as the requirement for trans youth to seek medical evaluations, to receive sex and or name changes, as well as the requirement of Canadian citizenship to change one's name and sex designation. Yeah, those are the first things that we saw that we won, which was really exciting. And the things that we were surprised about was we were actually surprised that we didn't was able to win the parental veto objection. We really wanted to remove and the quote-unquote right given to parents to deny their children's applications, because we had presented not only expert knowledge but also the lived experiences of trans and non-binary individuals who have been directly impacted by set requirement, you know, by set veto given to parents. So that was definitely devastating and also surprising, because we felt very confident in the information presented. And most importantly, we just thought it was shocking given, you know, the fact that they removed one gatekeeper, which are, you know, the medical evaluation from mental health practitioners, but yet, you know, another gatekeeper remains, which is parents. You know, not only is one living at home, potentially living at home with a transphobic parent, but then, you know, in order to, you know, potentially leave the house, you know, which requires getting a job and these different things, or even just trying to apply, you know, for assistance, that process in and of itself can be triggering if one is not able to, you know, put the name and sex designation that is theirs. So that thus then puts youth at risk for homelessness, which is again why we were really surprised and shocked by, you know, this very contradicting result. And we were also shockingly, very shocked by the fact that the requirement for sex designation is still required, given the extensive evidence presented about the harmful and forceful interventions done on intersex children at early ages. So, yeah, that upholding that requirement really erased the experiences of intersex individuals across Quebec.
What are some of the concrete things that changed from the day this decision was published?
So the Quebec government has until December 31st, 2021 to implement these changes to the Quebec Civil Code. The center will be observing and watching the Quebec Civil Code to verify that these changes will be made, and we'll be updating the community through our website and Facebook as we observe the changes. So in terms of has anything been, like, the material changes, it's still new because, you know, they have until technically December 31st, 2021 to implement that. But what it would look like when they occur is that people can change their sex designation to male, female, or X, and they would also, parents would also be able to change their parental role on their children's birth certificates. Trans migrants will also be able to change their name and sex designation, and all of these various things will have both social, financial, legal, as well as interpersonal implications to individuals living across Quebec.
What are some of the emotions that you're feeling, that the center is feeling, that you're seeing? Broadly speaking, this is a huge historic landmark to change parts of the provincial civil code.
For me, it was really definitely emotional. It was a multitude of emotions, happiness, relief, but also, you know, like grief as well, because of the two points that we lost. As I mentioned, you know, they have, it was such a contradictory blow that it was, yeah, like it was a mixture of emotions. I couldn't say that I felt any, you know, solely happy or solely upset. It was definitely a mixture of things because of the nature of the judgment. But I was also thinking about individuals who would directly be impacted by this. You know, I was thinking about all the trans, non-binary, and intersex migrants that frequently come to the center, that frequently message us about, you know, pathways into changing their name and sex designation. I was also thinking about trans parents being able to have their family recognized on a legal but also interpersonal level. You know, like these things can pop up in the very smallest ways through, you know, accessing daycare and accessing care, going to the you know, the hospital for your child. There's so many different implications in which, you know, one's privacy and safety, and also just sense of being recognized would be impacted. So yeah, I also started thinking about trans youth who, you know, now won't have to, you know, receive medical evaluation, which is also financially a burden for many. But then also thinking about the fact that they're, you know, the parental veto is still upheld, you know, and also just thinking about how this unstable position they're now left in, where it's like, okay, medical evaluations are no longer available, but, you know, my parent can still object, you know. So I was also thinking about that as well. And I was also thinking about intersex folks and just how the, you know, upholding sex designation just completely erases, you know, their experiences, the ongoing historical structurally enforced, you know, surgeries that are implemented on intersex folks. So yeah, those were all of the things that I was thinking about when we received the decision.
Is there anything else that is there anyone else that was part of this work that you wanted to mention?
Our co-plaintiffs are Samuel Singer, Sarah Blumel, Ivy Heller, and Jenna Jacobs. Our interveners are EGAL Canada, LGBT Family Coalition, and Gender Creative Kids. Also would like to thank our witnesses, our testifiers, all those folks who attended our trials, our peer support volunteers who were able to offer support, all the experts who were able to offer their knowledge, all individuals who are directly impacted, you know, our trans, our non-binary, our intersex folks living in Quebec currently, also through their very existence, supporting us in this court case, the legacy of the activism of trans women of color, the ongoing legacy and activism of trans women of color that spans and dates back since time. And also thinking about the trans organizations that are for and by trans folks, such as Aztec. I'm thinking about so many different folks in this. And of course, also too, thinking about the Concordia student body who volunteers, funds, and supports the Center for Gender Advocacy as well. And of course, as I mentioned, you know, thank you so much for Gabrielle Bouchard for launching this court case and Dahlia Torkey for spearheading the trial hearings. None of this would have been possible if it wasn't for them.
And my last question is, how is the center doing and how are you doing during COVID times?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in the COVID context, all of our things are online. We shifted to an online like context and platform the moment COVID-19 hit. So we're doing programming online. So for instance, we had our October 4th vigil for missing Indigenous women, girls, Two-Spirit, and Indigenous people on October 4th of this year. We also had a collaboration done with Fruition MTL, in which both of these activities were done and organized by our amazing programming coordinator, Dana Danger. And we're also offering peer support online via Zoom, in which people could register for free confidential peer support every Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m. Mondays and Wednesdays, sorry, from 3 to 5 p.m. And there is a possibility to set up an appointment if this time doesn't work for you. Just visit our website at genderadvocacy.org. And we've been pretty much just trying to, now that the court case is settled down, we are no longer open to the public, but we are still offering resources, which you can find on our website. And we are also offering peer support online still. What we're currently doing is focusing on visioning and bettering our strategies and ways of collaborating with the community, with various communities, I should say. So yeah, that's currently where we're at this present time. We are closed to the public from February 1st until May 10th, 2021. But again, we're still offering resources, which you can find on our website. And we're also offering peer support every Mondays and Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., in which you can register for this on our website at genderadvocacy.org. So yeah, that's it.
That was Jada Joseph with the Center for Gender Advocacy. If you want to know more about the work that they do or the decision that was passed down at the end of the month, you can visit them online at genderadvocacy.org. I'm Sarah Jesmer, and you're listening to CKUT.
I'm Brian Jefferson. And in some news you can use, this Valentine's Day marks the 11th annual vigil for missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, trans, and Two-Spirit relatives. The vigil is going online this year on Sunday, 6 to 8 p.m., and is organized by groups like the Iskewil Project, Missing Justice, and the Center for Gender Advocacy. If you want to know more, you can search for Missing Justice on Facebook. Speaking of Valentine's Day, Occupy the Hood is organizing a Black Love Market. You can buy clothing, art, jewelry, and more from the Black-owned businesses this weekend. The market is at Bar Pamplemousse on St. Laurent from 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. And we've set up a voicemail box to hear from people as they're isolated and quarantining. Call us to leave a short voicemail, and we might play it on air. That number is 514-448-4041, extension 7000.
And that's it for this Friday's edition of Off the Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This show is produced by Montreal's Community News Collective, which includes Brian Jefferson, Grace Cobalt, and Alice Wu. and is produced by Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you want to be part of this team and help carry these stories produced by and for the Montreal community, please reach out to CKUT's Community News Department by email at newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can connect with us on Facebook. Search for CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe, coming up next. See you next week.
De la nation québécoise. Nous devons agir avec force pour freiner la pandémie. Seuls les services essentiels demeurent offerts. Les rassemblements sont interdits. Il est défendu de quitter son domicile entre 20h et 5h le matin. Respectons le confinement et le couvre-feu pour éviter d'être infectés par le virus de la COVID-19. Pour protéger les travailleurs de la santé, nos proches et nos aînés. Car l'important, c'est la santé. Pour plus d'informations, visitez québec.ca/confinement. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Bonsoir tout le monde, bienvenue à votre émission culturelle préférée, l'émission Café sur les ondes de CKUT. C'est Alex qui vous parle, il est 18h et ce soir nous avons une